Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Today, the President of the United States goes on trial in the Senate. It is a test of this president, of the presidency, of the Constitution. You may be exhausted by the constant media coverage, the spinning and maneuvering emanating from Capitol Hill, but you can't get away from the fact that this is history in the making. So as we think through our coverage of the coming days, we wanted to start by stepping back, talking with historians about how they're looking at this moment and what they're looking for. So this hour on Point, the presidency, the Congress, the Constitution, and past as prologue. And you can join us. Do you see what's unfolding today as a key test of our form of government? Is your spine tingling with anticipation? Do you think Congress will rise to the solemnity of this occasion? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We've got two terrific historians with us today. Rachel Sheldon joins us. She's a professor of history at Penn State, specializing in the 19th century. She's author of a book called Washington Brotherhood, Politics, Social Life, and the Coming of the Civil War. Professor Sheldon, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
Also with us is Mark Updegrove. He is a presidential historian and president and CEO of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Foundation, which supports the LBJ Presidential Library and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's also author of The Last Republicans, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Mark Updegrove, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna.
And full disclosure here, just as we get going, Rachel, you were one of the more than 2,000 American historians who signed a statement in December calling for the impeachment of President Trump. Just wanted to put that out there.
That's right.
So I just want to begin with this question that, you know, this is a historical moment. It has only happened two other times in U.S. history. So Rachel, what are you looking for as we begin this process?
Well, I'm looking for a lot of things, but one of the most important things I'm interested in is how history is used in this process, how it's weaponized, how both sides talk about it, but especially how the Trump administration tries to spin the issue of history. And we've seen that already in the impeachment briefs, the briefs for the trial, in particular referring to the Federalist Papers and to previous impeachments. History is often weaponized for various causes. And in this case, the Johnson trial from 1868, I think, really served as a model for members of the Trump administration. Mike Pence, for example, had an op-ed recently in the Wall Street Journal where he talked about one of the folks who voted to acquit President Johnson during the impeachment trial and painted him as a really good, good-hearted and really mindful senator. And in fact, he was bribed to vote against conviction of President Johnson. And as a result, I think we have to be careful to see what the historical precedents are and the way they're used.
Okay. Important caveat. Nevertheless, I'm going to ask about historical precedents.
Yes.
So Mark Updegrove, I mean, same question to you to get us started. What are you looking for as the Senate begins this process today?
You know, I think Gerald Ford set the standard for how we should respond to times like this in our history. And interestingly, when he was the House Minority Leader in 1970, he said an impeachable offense is whatever the House of Representatives considers it to be at any moment in history. That was 4 years before he assumed the presidency upon the resignation of Richard Nixon. And at that very sober moment in our history, after he was sworn into office as our first unelected president, he made his remarks. And we all remember him saying, "Our long national nightmare is over." But we, I think, lose sight of what he said next, which I think is more important. He said, "Our Constitution works. Mm. We are a nation of laws and not men. Here the people rule." And I'm wondering, at this moment in history, are we still a nation of law and laws and not men? Does our Constitution work? Do the people rule in our country? And so that's going to depend on the impartiality of the jurors who preside over this trial, Republicans and Democrats alike.
So I've heard various experts, historians say something very similar to what you just said, Mark, that, you know, that they are wondering if the Constitution still works. I'll be honest, every time I hear that, it sends a chill down my spine. The very fact that that question is in the air at the moment. I mean, what is your answer to that question? Do you believe the Constitution is still working right now?
Yeah, the fact is that the Constitution is simply an expression of the ideals of our founding fathers. They are just ideas etched on parchment. Our willingness to uphold them depends on each generation's appetite for what this republic should look like. I don't know at this time in our history whether we are serious about upholding our constitutional ideals. If we allow, I think, the president to invite foreign powers into our electoral process, it sets a precedent for future commanders-in-chief, for future presidents. That's what I'm deeply concerned about, the precedent that this sets, whether it's constitutional or not.
Mm. So the behavior of the president and the office of the presidency, one area of concern. But Rachel, shouldn't we also apply that same lens to the Congress and the Senate?
I do think we have to do that. The biggest concern I have is that we get too bogged down in the details and lose sight of the bigger questions about what this means for democracy. And this is what all of the impeachment questions have been in the other two times that it has happened. Mm. And then today, right, thinking about, are we at a moment where our democracy is in danger? And in 1868, we were. We were at a moment in which Reconstruction of the South was in danger by the president. And today we are having questions about whether our free and fair elections are in danger because of this president. And so that is the question at the heart of all of this. And although we can get focused on these particular details of Ukraine, we do have to keep the broader context of what this is all about, what the democratic problem is here.
Mm. So I keep coming back to the idea that this has only happened two other times in all of the history of this country since its founding, since the Constitution was first written. N equals two is a pretty low number to make good comparisons. You know, I think about that. But I am wondering, and I'll ask both of you this, but Rachel, let's start with you. Are the two previous impeachment trials of President Clinton and President Johnson the best comparisons for this moment, or should we be looking at other moments in history?
I think the Johnson impeachment and trial is a very good comparison. There are very similar issues, very similar concerns. Both happened in an election year. Both happened because of a great fear of democracy failing. And in 1868, there were real questions about whether the president would be stopped from behaving the way he had been behaving. And that is a big reason for this impeachment, the concerns about whether there could be any end to interference in the election. And in 1868, there were real concerns about whether President Johnson would stop interfering with what Congress was doing. So I do think it's a good comparison. I think it's a good comparison in thinking about the future of the nation and the future of the democratic experiment. We've talked a lot in the media and I think often on college campuses and elsewhere about the fact that this is a political process, and sometimes that's used in a negative. But frankly, it's a it's at the heart of what our democracy is about, right? This impeachment process involves all three branches of government. It involves a solemn evaluation of where we are as a nation, and that was true in 1868, just as it is now.
Andrew Johnson's trial ended in acquittal.
It did.
Okay. Mark Updegrove, then, your same question to you. Are the previous two impeachments, do you think, the best or most instructive moments in history to use as a comparison?
Well, I think if you're looking at the two, Magna, there's no doubt that the Johnson impeachment trial is more similar to what we're seeing today. And what happened then is the Congress took President Johnson to task for firing his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, when they believed that they had veto power over moves like that. So it was executive overreach, which I think we're seeing with these charges leveled against Donald Trump. I think that there are other moments in American history where we see political expedience getting in the way of doing the right thing and upholding one's responsibility as an elected official. I think probably McCarthyism is a good example of that. And we saw in Joseph McCarthy, a senator from Wisconsin, this abuse of power as a senator. And we saw a lot of other senators and representatives lining up behind him because it was the politically expedient thing to do. And when Senator McCarthy's popularity eroded over time, it was safe for those lining up behind him to disassociate themselves with his cause. And he was ultimately censured by the Senate, his colleagues, and it led to his ignominious downfall. So I think that there are other moments aside from impeachment proceedings that can be invoked at this time.
Well, when we come back from the break, I want to explore that much more with the both of you. We are talking this hour, we're taking a step back, I should say, as the Senate begins its trial of the President of the United States and looking at history and what it can teach us about how to understand this moment. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how to look through the lens of history to get a sense of what's at stake today as the Senate begins its trial of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Mark Updegrove. He's presidential historian and president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation. Rachel Sheldon also joins us. She's a professor of history at Penn State, specializing in the 19th century. And Mark, before the break, you were saying that you think looking at the McCarthy era in U.S. history is instructive at this moment. And you said that it was a time in which political expedience got in the way of doing the right thing. But eventually, the right thing did happen, right? As you were noting, voices of conscience stood up. I'm thinking about Margaret Chase Smith, for example, from Maine. But something had to catalyze that, right? There had to be, like you said, this sort of ebbing away of McCarthy's popularity. What were those forces that made that happen? And do you see those similar forces anywhere in the American body politic today?
Well, it's a very different We live in a very different society than we did in the 1950s. One of the major factors in Senator McCarthy's losing his popularity and losing momentum was Edward R. Murrow coming out on television and essentially saying that this was a witch hunt and this was a bastardization of American ideals. And we have in today's America a very different media landscape. It's total fragmentation. And that's an enormous difference between now and then. We don't look to certain media personalities like Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow and others to tell us what to make of the news. We have these different media outlets which have become echo chambers. And they give us the version of reality that we wish to subscribe to, whether it's based in fact or not. And that's a little bit disturbing. There's not one central place where we can all get together and understand the goings-on of any particular day. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at Fox News, it's a very different America, and it's a very different political system, and it's a very different president than if you're watching CNN or MSNBC. If you're looking at Breitbart, it's a very different version of events than if you're reading the New York Times.
American media is fractured. To me, it feels like a crystal ball that's been dropped and it is in a billion different pieces on the floor for sure. But I mean, let's be honest. You're on a media outlet right now, and this is something we think about every day. And we ask ourselves, are we doing the right thing right now? Are we doing a good job? And I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I mean, because it's easy to beat up on Fox and Breitbart, MSNBC, but there are also other large quote unquote mainstream media outlets that are also part of this moment too.
It's a very different time in history, and I think that media outlets should all, just as the jurors in this trial. Should be thinking about impartiality, be thinking about dispassion. There's no ignoring the fact that you have these media outlets that are purveying a certain point of view because it's good business. And we have social media doing the exact same thing, Meghna. And I think that it's not been a bad exercise for American journalism to be introspective, to figure out what it is to be a responsible news vehicle in the 21st century during the so-called information age.
Mm. Well, Rachel Sheldon, let me turn back to you. First of all, let me just give you a chance. Did you want to respond to what Mark was saying?
I was just going to say, I think what's really interesting about that is that the 19th century media landscape looked a lot more like it does today. Hmm. Newspapers in the 19th century were specifically partisan. They were representative of political parties. And there were many more political parties in the 19th century, but each newspaper had an affiliation with a political party and was open about it. And as a result, you had very partisan and specifically partisan news that came out and that people would read. And if you were a Democrat, you were likely to read Democratic newspapers. And if you were a Republican, you were likely to read Republican newspapers if you read the newspapers at all. But at the same time, you had congressmen, senators behaving differently. They had a different kind of relationship in Washington. That's what allowed President Johnson to be acquitted. I'm not going to weigh in on whether that was the right decision, but part of what happened in the Johnson impeachment trial is that behind the scenes, Johnson was speaking to people in Congress and assuring them that he would stop interfering with Reconstruction if they would acquit him. So behind the scenes, there are all kinds of conversations happening, negotiation happening among congressmen and the president to try to figure out what would go on if the president was acquitted. And that doesn't really seem possible in today's landscape. Certainly, senators from the various parties are not talking to one another, and the president is not assuring anyone that his behavior will change. So one of the things that we should be paying attention to is how President Trump is reacting to this and whether it's having any kind of constricting effect on his behavior.
But what we do have, though, is a behind-the-scenes cooperation between the Senate Majority Leader, who set the rules for this trial today, and the White House, right? And it's not even all that much behind the scenes, right? I mean,
that's right.
Because Senator McConnell has said, I'm going to run this trial exactly how the president wants. So it's even more sort of tightly bound together than in the 19th century, Rachel.
Well, there's a parallel to that because in the 19th century, the person who sat at the head of the trial, just as today, was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And that person was Salmon Chase, who had been a longtime congressman from Ohio. And he was very interested in the Democratic nomination for president in 1868. And so he coordinated with people on the Democratic side to try to get President Johnson acquitted. And this was part of his plan. He helped negotiate the rules and influence the rules to reflect an interest in getting an acquittal. And so you do have that same kind of negotiation going on. But there's more conversation that happened in the 19th century than is happening today among various partisan groups.
Mark, do we see in any other period in U.S. history party leadership working in such lockstep with the president?
Well, I want to go back to what your comments about Mitch McConnell. He not only said he was going to work in lockstep with the president, he said he was an impartial juror. He said that from the very beginning, before taking the oath before this trial, indicating that he would be impartial. He said he was incapable of doing that. That was not going to happen. But I want to go back to when the system, I think, worked, which was back to the Nixon era. On the contrary, you didn't get the Republican leadership working with the White House. Instead, you had Barry Goldwater, the iconic senator from Arizona, John Rhodes, the House Minority Leader, and Hugh Scott, the Senate Minority Leader, going to Richard Nixon in early August of 1974, telling him that he would almost certainly be impeached in the House of Representatives and convicted by the Senate in a trial around the Watergate burglary and Nixon's involvement in the cover-up. That is stark. These are all Republican stalwarts, and they're telling a Republican president of the United States that he will not last these trials. And that prompted Richard Nixon to resign from the presidency, the first and only president in U.S. history to do so. That was at a time when I think all of our leaders in Congress were more likely to put country over party, which is precisely what Senator Goldwater, Senator Scott, and Representative Rhodes were doing at that moment in history, that very perilous moment in history.
So let me ask you then, Mark. I mean, I think this is so important. If, as this Senate trial wraps up, if the Senate acquits President Trump, have we then entered an era where we've solidified the political gains to be had by putting party before country?
I think almost certainly. But the danger in that is that we can easily get a Democratic president in the office in 2020 or in 2024. And will the Republican Party be able to live with the same precedents that they have abided by in 2020? So that's the danger here, Magna. Again, I mentioned it at the top of the program, the precedent that we set.
Yeah, it's almost like permanently moving the goalposts here. Rachel, what did you think about that?
I agree, but at the same time, I think this is pretty much the precedent from the past. Congressmen, senators look to the public to see what they should and should not be doing. And specifically in this case, they're looking to their own constituents. And I think there's a real belief that if these folks are going to vote for conviction, that they will be removed from office and that their constituents will be unhappy. And some of that has to do with gerrymandering and voter suppression and the ways in which elections have already been affected. But this is true throughout history. These folks in Congress are going to behave with their own interest and also the interest of the publics that they serve in mind. And you know, you can have both things. You can try and do the right thing for the country and you can serve your constituents, but we're at a moment in which serving constituents is really important. That might be a good comparison to where things stood in the 1850s, just before the Civil War, where congressmen often made these very fiery speeches mm-hmm. to sort of drum up anger among their constituents in 1860, early 1861, just before the Civil War. And these constituents were angrier and angrier and angrier. And as a result, you had a deadly Civil War. Four years, 750,000 men died. And they are responsible in large part for it, even though they were trying to do things behind the scenes. So the public is really the main focus here, I think, for a lot of the senators who are looking at this situation, and there are benefits and drawbacks to that.
This is so interesting because earlier when Mark mentioned McCarthyism, ultimately that broke in the direction of accountability, right? And Rachel, you're right now talking about pre-Civil War drumming up of passions and furies by legislators in their constituents ending in the Civil War. So, I mean, history can break in either direction.
Absolutely, it can. And one of the things that I think is similar, although you have to be very careful to say it's the same when you're drawing historical comparisons, but similar is that there is a real dislike of Congress in the nation. And that was true in the period just before the Civil War as well. There was real distrust of Congress. There was real distrust of congressmen, especially from the other section. And a lot of that had to do with the fiery speeches that these men were making on the floor of the House and Senate. They were drumming up anger against the people from the other section. It didn't quite work the same way as today because we were talking about a sectional disagreement between northern and southern states. And today we're talking more in terms of partisanship, but it's a similar kind of effect.
Hmm. Well, let's actually listen to a couple of pieces of tape from our current Senate trial just to sort of get a comparison about from the 19th century to the 20th century to now. Early in the 21st century. Here's House Republican Doug Collins of Georgia, part of the president's defense team. He was on Fox and Friends this morning saying that in this impeachment trial, he believes the truth will out.
Senator McConnell has actually laid out a rather expeditious process here. I think you'll see both cases laid out this week. But this is going to be a great time for the American people when the Adam Schiff and the other House impeachment managers get up to lay out this very flimsy case in which they're going to try and distract. They're going to talk about innuendo. They're going to talk about hearsay. They're going to talk about everything except the true fact that they just don't like this president. And then you'll hear the White House counsel get up and begin to lay out the case in a long format to show that what is actually about. This is actually about a House majority that did not like this president, that did not want him to continue, and they also needed it for next year's election.
That's House Republican Doug Collins of Georgia. Now, here's Alaskan Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski. She's hoping for a responsible and thoughtful impeachment trial.
I care about the roles and responsibilities that we have that have, were outlined in the Constitution, and making sure that we're doing right by them. And so I don't want this proceeding to be a circus. I don't want it to be viewed as a mockery or a kangaroo court.
That's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski. Let's go to Ronald, who's calling from Auburn Hills, Michigan. Ronald, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just really concerned at this point, and that's why I called. I've got a 15-year-old son, and we, on more than one occasion, have had conversations about what's going on right now, and I'm very concerned about what I would call honesty and civility. And the civility part of this issue is these guys aren't being civil with one another, and they're setting really bad examples for young people because they're looking at what's going on right now. Honesty doesn't change. Either you're being honest or you're not being honest, and either you're showing what's truthful or you're not showing what's truthful. So for these guys to sit there and on a daily basis talk about things that really don't matter is ridiculous. They should just let these folks have a full clearing of views, and anyone that should testify, so that all of us can get to the truth and put this behind us.
Ronald, thank you. I'm going to just take it back from you there, but thank you so much for your call. Mark Updegrove, you want to respond to Ronald? He's saying civility itself in American politics is on trial.
Well, I don't know about on trial. I think it's certainly in peril. He also mentioned honesty, Meghna, and it's interesting to note how important honesty is as we evaluate, as we look at our political icons. When we look at George Washington, even in our youngest years, we remember those. That the legend of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and then coming clean about it and saying, I cannot lie. I chopped down that cherry tree. We remember Abraham Lincoln as Honest Abe. And I think that honesty is the bedrock of the presidency. And my hope is that we get back to an era where there's greater honesty in our political system in general.
Well, we are talking this hour about how we look through the lens of history to understand what's at stake in this moment today as the Senate trial of President Trump begins. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with a couple of historians to look through the lens of history to understand the significance of this moment today as the Senate begins its trial of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Mark Updegrove. He's a presidential historian and president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and author of The Last Republicans, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Rachel Sheldon also joins us as well. She's a professor of history at Penn State, specializing in the 19th century, and author of Washington Brotherhood, Politics, Social Life, and the Coming of the Civil War. And Rachel, before the break, we were listening to our caller talk about a cry for honesty. And Mark gave us his thoughts about that, as honesty being a cornerstone of how American democracy is supposed to function. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
I think throughout the 19th century and the 20th century, we've had different stories about our nation, right? Stories about what our nation is and what it's meant to be. And that's really what all of the politicians in this impeachment trial are going to try to do. They're going to try to explain their story of what happened and their story of what that means for American democracy. And we'll see that, I think, both with the senators and with the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who I think is trying to tell a story about impartiality and about the importance of impartiality and the importance of looking at the truth, as he would say. But I think all of these folks have their own biases and concerns about their well-being, including John Roberts. So truth is a subjective experience for most of these politicians and has been throughout American history from the very beginning. Mm.
Well, let's go to Jonathan, who's calling from Hyden, Kentucky. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern is, since the president took office, he's been investigated. So, you know, they've got their evidence, and now we're at an impeachment. If this impeachment, if he gets voted, found acquitted, not guilty, will this be it? And then will we go back to trying to work on, you know, passing laws, getting things done for the country? Or could we be possibly looking at, you know, maybe 6 more years of investigations if he's reelected? I just want to know, when will enough be enough? And thank you for taking my call.
Jonathan, thank you for that question. Mark, do you dare posit an answer for him?
Well, it's a fluid situation. Yeah. The president's behavior does not stop after this trial ends, whether he's acquitted or not. If he is acquitted, he will go on to function as our president, and he must be held accountable. And if there are other actions that he take that warrant investigation, I hope our senators, our congressmen, Republican and Democrat alike, will ensure that there is a check on that executive power. That is the basis of our system, checks and balances. And one cannot act with impunity. So, yes, we have investigated this president. I think his actions, in my opinion, have warranted that investigation, and we must hold him or any other president to account for their actions now and in the offing.
Mm. Well, Rachel, jumping back to the Johnson impeachment in 1868, even though he was acquitted, did it serve as a check on executive power?
I think that's the key point here, right, is taking a step back and thinking not specifically about this trial, but about the point of the trial and the point of the investigations, which is about the future of democracy. Will we have free and fair elections? Will the 2020 election be interfered with by this president, by foreign powers? And in 1868, what happened is that the president agreed to take a step back from interfering with Reconstruction. And as a result, we got the ratification of the 14th Amendment. We've got the 15th Amendment. We've got massive change in the South. We've got the military protecting African-American voters. This is not going to go on forever, as we know, but it is really important that the impeachment process and the trial, even though it resulted in acquittal, actually ended up with the Republicans who were pushing for these changes being successful in protecting democracy in the South.
I'm just thinking, yes, point taken, but that all came after Civil War as well. And to, you know, you were saying earlier how legislators were, you know, through the hyper-partisan media of the 19th century, were fomenting discontent back in their constituencies. I mean, did they know? Did they have a sense as to the impact of their hyper-political speech and what impact it was having back in various states?
Well, yes, I think that's a really key point. I mean, impeachment was not necessarily as popular as Republicans would have liked it to be, but the actions of the president are what mattered there. Was the president going to participate or not? So this is after the Civil War, and there's a real concern about whether there will be another Civil War if Southern states are not checked, if their behavior is not altered, if African Americans are not given the ability to behave as full citizens, if they are re-enslaved. These are genuine concerns. And Andrew Johnson had really been making that difficult by pardoning over 7,000 former Confederates, by taking the land back from freed people. This was a real concern that Republicans had. So again, their investigations of President Johnson, which started well before 1868, really are about the future of democracy. And that's why we have to be more concerned about what is happening that is causing these investigations? What are the concerns that the Democrats in Congress have about free and fair elections, and less about the very, very particulars of whether we have to go through another trial? So I would agree with Mark. I would hope that if there continues to be interference with the elections, that the Democrats in the House will continue to look to check this president.
Mark, are we at another future of democracy moment right now?
In some ways, I think we are, Meghna. You know, this is, as Rachel suggested, this is about – this trial is ultimately about whether President Trump is found guilty or not. It is about inviting a foreign power to interfere in our electoral process. that's something that the founding fathers feared almost more than anything else. George Washington talks about it in his very famous farewell speech as he leaves the presidency after two terms in office. At the heart of our democracy is a free and fair electoral process. If that's in jeopardy, then we are no longer the United States of America as imagined by our founding fathers and upheld by generations before us. I just may I go back to one thing, Meg, that one of the callers said before?
Of course.
He lamented the decline of civility. And I think it's we haven't really talked about the polarization that we see in America today and what has led to that. But Rachel alluded to it earlier when she was talking about the redistricting. And I think that has led to the extreme polarization that we see in America today. You have gerrymandering that has led to a safe district for one party or another, and that's led to a kind of extremism in the primary process. And a lot of the reason that there is the fear that there is in Washington today is because our senators, our representatives fear being challenged in the primary and losing their office as a result of the extremism we see as a consequence of gerrymandering. Mm.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. My question is, in the Johnson impeachment, was there a component of behind the scenes the fact that he was just disliked because of the way he was trying to handle Reconstruction?
That he was just plain old disliked? Well, Rachel Sheldon, what's your answer to that?
Well, he was certainly disliked, but the reasons why he was disliked is that he was specifically trying to obstruct congressional action as it came to Reconstruction. So Congress was passing legislation to reconstruct the South, and Johnson was doing everything in his power and you might say beyond the politically appropriate behavior of the president to obstruct those legislative moves. And so he was disliked not because of anything that had to do with his background, but really because he was trying to obstruct Congress. He was trying to obstruct the behavior of Congress. What I think maybe your caller is referring to is there's sort of an old historical belief that exists, I think, among the public at large, that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson was a negative and that Reconstruction in particular was a negative, that this was a terrible time in American society. This is sort of an older belief that existed at the end of the 19th century that many Southerners, white Southerners, tried to promote. And we haven't really dealt with that as a society yet. Historians would argue that Reconstruction was one of the most important and progressive moments in American history. You have really, for the first time, African Americans participating in huge numbers in political spaces and voting once they get the vote in the 15th Amendment. And as a result, we have sort of this disconnect between what historians believe about the Reconstruction period and what society as a whole believes. So Reconstruction was an incredibly important moment. It was incredibly important that Congress chose to reconstruct these areas to try to make them freer and more democratic. And we can't look at that as a negative.
Well, let's go to Rudy now, who's calling from Santa Cruz, Arizona. Rudy, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much for including these historians that can hear what led up to the last Civil War and some of the consequences. But I wanted to, if you could comment on the rise of social media and how it has fundamentally changed our tendency to be a nation of personality and not laws because of the timing that it allows people to get a message out. I believe my personal opinion is that Facebook's priority towards profits has an inordinate preference towards anarchy because it draws a better media audience. And we just happen to have a president whose business style mm-hmm. is to do anarchy so that he can create an authoritarian business state. And we're now seeing the parallel of that on a national level.
Yeah. Rudy, it's a really interesting question, and thank you for your call. Mark, you want to answer her?
Sure, Magna. I think that the best politicians master the mediums of their times.
Right.
So you have Abraham Lincoln, a master of the written word. When he made a speech, you couldn't hear that speech because there was no broadcast medium, but it would be published in newspapers across the states. He also dabbled in used the fledgling art of photography in his campaign in 1860. We see Franklin Roosevelt using radio brilliantly to get us through the Great Depression, and it was a great political tool for Roosevelt. We see John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan using the art of television, the medium of television, for their political purposes. We saw Barack Obama use social media and the internet, and we see, I think, this president using, in some ways politically, whether you agree with him or not, brilliantly, mm-hmm. Twitter to get his message out. It's a means of circumventing the media and getting your message out directly to the American people. And it's really come to bear in his ability to talk directly to his constituents. Again, whether you agree with his point of view or not, he has mastered that medium.
Yeah.
But in terms of how social media has affected our democracy, I mean, you can see very clearly that the Russians interfered in 2016 and used our social media platforms to do that. We have always, almost since the beginning of television, we've regulated television. There are certain do's and don'ts that broadcasters have to abide by. And I think we have to think very seriously about applying regulations to our social media outlets.
Well, we've just got a couple minutes left to go in this conversation, and I'm curious. I'm going to ask both of you to cast your minds forward, say a century from now, and play future historian for us. I mean, Rachel, if you were in the year 2120, looking back as a historian, what do you think you'd see?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Historians, we are not used to, I think, projecting forward. We generally think backwards. But I would say that one thing that I would certainly be looking for as a historian 100 years from now is what was going on behind the scenes. How did these various players in the political system try and figure out the way to behave? Certainly Mitch McConnell's papers will be very interesting if we ever get a chance to look at them. And trying to understand how those relationships affect the way this plays out in the trial over the next few weeks. And one other thing I would be looking for is the way that each side presents its arguments through the prism of the past. And we've seen this a lot again already in thinking about how the Trump administration has weaponized various parts of Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Papers and talked about the Johnson impeachment and the way that Democrats have responded by pointing out the importance of some of the thinkers in the first half of the 19th century who talked about how important it is to really see impeachment as a political process.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we've got about less than a minute for you to answer that same impossible question.
Well, Magda, it takes at least a generation for us to get a clear perspective on a previous era in history and a president. But I would say, when we look back at this era, we should judge this president as we should any president on two things. Did he make the nation stronger in posterity? And did he do, in Lyndon Johnson's words, the greatest good for the greatest number? And I can't answer those questions, but history has a good way of sorting all those things out.
Well, Mark Updegrove is a presidential historian and president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and author of The Last Republicans, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Megan. It was a pleasure.
And Rachel Sheldon, a professor of history at Penn State, specializing in the 19th century and author of Washington Brotherhood, Politics, Social Life, and the Coming of the Civil War. Rachel, it was a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Magna. Enjoyed it.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.